You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. Our topic today is military history. We're talking with military historian Wilbur Jones, and we've been talking primarily about World War II matters, which we can continue doing, but there's lots of other things we'll try to talk about in the final segment of today's program. So you've got about 15 minutes. If you want to ask Wilbur a question or make a comment, by calling 910-343-1138. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, Wilbur is captain in the U.S. Navy Reserve, retired, immediate past chairman of the USS North Carolina Battleship Commission, and chairman of the World War II Wilmington Homefront Heritage Commission. And he is actively working on trying to get the designation of Wilmington as America's first World War II city. And that's proceeding in Congress right now. A couple of things here. One caller called again. I guess they didn't hear what we were talking about earlier, referring to the rumor about a German submariner found on shore dead with a movie ticket in his pocket from a Wilmington theater. And I gather, Wilbur, you don't think that that's a credible thing, but it's a nice legend. Anyway.
Yes, it's fun to talk about.
Yeah, fun to talk about. That's good. And we also have an email. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. This is from Bill West, a fellow Forest Hills School alumnus, listening on the Internet from Oak Ridge, where he now lives up in the Triad area. He says, it's good to hear, Wilbur, that you're still in the game. Thank you for your efforts to get Wilmington rightly recognized for World War II activities.
Bill West and I grew up together, and during World War II, we and other neighborhood kids, we fought all the battles on the home front here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, went through Forest Hills and New Hanover High School together. So, Bill, thanks for checking in, and we miss you down here. Sorry you had to move.
Well, let's talk about a couple of other things here, Wilbur, while we're waiting for some more callers at 910-343-1138. People who've been on Topsail Island see these structures, these concrete structures along there. Tell us about those. Those played a role in the war, did they not?
No, post-war.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Post-war.
Yeah.
Okay.
After the war, a couple of years after the war, the Navy began testing rocket propulsion and rocketry on Topsail Island and their missile program. And those towers, many of which are still there, were used for spotting and observation and other technicalities regarding the firing of rockets and missiles. In fact, their museum on Topsail Island is called Missiles and More Museum. And if you're ever in that area, drop in, because it is probably it's the best museum to Camp Davis of World War II that's in existence.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll recommend that to folks, and perhaps people can take advantage of that. But it's just a strange thing to drive along the coast there and see these big concrete bunker-type things on there. I wanted to ask you about something in a kind of different direction, Wilbur, knowing a little bit about your background. In addition to your work as a military historian, and I know you've led tours of various places, battlefields and things like that. But you also have had a career on the civilian side of things, and you were active in the White House under a couple of presidents. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I've had a wonderful career in staff politics, which began in Los Angeles, took me to Washington, D.C., and I spent 28 years in Washington, not all of which was in politics. But I had the pleasure of working my way up from being a precinct chairman in Los Angeles to working for two California Republican congressmen, one of whom was Barry Goldwater Jr., Senator Goldwater's son, who took me to Washington with him when he was elected. And I had a number of political staff positions in Washington and worked my way into the White House, where I served for 2 years as an advance representative and assistant to President Gerald Ford. And it was obviously the most remarkable part of my life and most remarkable and rewarding time that I have ever spent. President Ford was the best boss I ever had. He was everything you have heard about him being, a kind and congenial and very accommodating man with the responsibility he had. And it was also a 20-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job.
Oh, I'm sure.
And
yeah.
And I was particularly brought home here over the July 4th weekend because I advanced his trip to New York City on July 4th of 1976, which was our nation's bicentennial.
Of course.
And
the tall ships in New York
and
Harbor.
The tall ships, yeah. And the International Naval Review. And I had him on a Navy ship out in New York Harbor, and it began to rain. He disappeared. The Secret Service and I and his body man could not find him. Eventually, he showed up with the captain. He'd gone up to the captain's cabin, talked to the crew, had a cup of coffee, came back down. I said, "Mr. President, where have you been? We lost you." And he said, "No harm, Wilbur. I was up having a cup of coffee with the captain." And we were quite relieved because I became the only advance man in the Ford White House that ever lost the president. But it was raining like crazy.
But at
crazy.
Least they found him again.
And listen, part of my job—
And the
job,
statute of limitations is probably expired.
That's right.
On that.
But I tell you, I could still feel the cold rain because it was cold. I was freezing on the Air Force One coming home back to Washington, D.C., because I have to hold the umbrella over the president. He stays dry and I get wet.
Yeah. Well, let's take a couple more calls from World War II, about World War II from our listeners. Our guest is Wilbur Jones. I'm Cleve Callison, your host for Coastline. 910-343-1138 or coastline@whqr.org. Let's say hello to Rusty from Oak Island. Rusty, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm 69 and was in my early years in Wilmington. Third in Dawson area when Dawson was a two-way street. And I remember as a child putting up their houses. My dad and my uncle had to search the houses, look under the beds, the closets for German and Japanese. And they winked as me as a child to come join them. But before my aunt and my mom and grandmother could go in, we had to clear the premises. So where did that fear come from? There was Wilmington that, you know, that at risk or what?
Rusty, you're talking about something that happened after the war or during the war?
Yeah. I was born just at the end of the war, about 69. And that may have been a family.
Yeah, so that fear persisted long after the war was over then.
Yeah. We had green shades hanging from the window, kind of a, you know, throwback to blackout and things like that, I think, that Wilmington experienced. I'm just wondering if it was founded or, you know, what's the reason? Was it my family needing help then, or was it a great fear that gripped this city?
Well, during World War II, there was a fear for the first 2 years of the war that we could be attacked at any time. And I have very vivid memories of blackouts and having to pull shades down and street lights that were painted black on the top and air raid sirens going off and airplanes going out to attack submarines that may or may not be there. Yes, there was that fear because the government let us know that the possibility of attack. And from 1944 on, it started to wane, and then as the war turned in our favor. But post-war, I don't remember that in post-war because after the war ended, I mean, we were back to as normal as we could be.
Rusty, thank you for your call. You know, that does bring to mind the fact that we're probably much more aware of this today. There's been a lot more publicity about the effects of now what we call PTSD, and in World War I think they called it shell shock. I'm not sure what they called it in World War II, but there certainly were some people who had psychological effects long after the war was over, whether they were in combat or not, just the great fear that came about. We had a comment here at Coastline. The listener is no longer on the line, but Darcel from Leland called in with a comment, and she wanted to talk about the fact that there's a lot of talk about the greatest generation, referring to the people who fought World War II, the Americans who went to war, either willingly or being drafted, and wanted to hear a discussion about why aren't African Americans mentioned specifically. And I guess Truman desegregated the military after World War II, or maybe in 1948 or something like that, according to Darcel. But there certainly were African-American soldiers who were part of the war effort, were there not?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And here
the
in
Tuskegee
Wilmington,
Airmen and
well, the
like
Tuskegee Airmen, I've studied extensively, and the service that they provided as fighter pilots over in the European campaign. During World War II, the services were segregated. And the African Americans were utilized primarily in the rear echelon areas as cargo handlers and stevedores and in clerical jobs. There were a couple of divisions, all black divisions, infantry divisions, and tank battalions that did see service, but the Tuskegee Airmen were the more famous ones. Here in Wilmington, we had Camp Davis soldiers. Many of them were black, and they had their own club, which was at 9th and Nixon Street, which now is the Community Boys and Girls Club. The building itself is very similar to the Hannah Block Historic USO at 2nd and Orange Street. But one thing I remember so much, and in doing my research for my books, was that the best clubs in town were the black clubs. The black clubs attracted the Duke Ellington and Ella Fitzgerald and Cab Calloway and that type of entertainment. And they wouldn't come to the white clubs. Hmm. And they didn't play Lumina. And the clubs were segregated as well. But it was a whole different time then.
Mm-hmm. But it's important to recognize that contribution.
Yes.
So, Darcel, thank you very much for that call. It's very important. You're listening to Coastline. We've got about, 5 minutes or so left for your call. So hurry up if you want to get on the air. 910-343-1138 is the number. And our email address is coastline@whqr.org. You lead tours of battlefields. I mentioned that you, I think you've led tours in Europe, in France, and other places like that. But you also lead tours around this area, I believe.
Yes, I do.
Historic sites. What are some of the places that you go on those tours?
Well, in the Pacific, I've taken them to a lot of the Pacific battlefields. But most of my attention in recent years has been in Europe. Battle of the Bulge, Normandy, D-Day, the invasion of southern France, Operation Market Garden in the Netherlands, and so on. But locally, I do lead tours for about a 3.5-hour tour of the World War II sites here. We go to Fort Fisher and see the base there. We go see the prisoner of war camps. We go over to the shipyard, which is still important because many of the buildings that were built for the shipyard are still in use by the State Ports Authority. And we go to New Hanover High School to see the memorial to our two Medal of Honor recipients and take them to a number of places like that. And if anyone is interested in a tour like that, contact me.
Yeah, give us a call here at the station, 910-343-1138. I wanted to mention, I don't think she's on the line, but Nicole from Wilmington, who is a social worker dealing with mental health issues, we talked about the fact of PTSD. She said in World War II, it was sometimes called combat fatigue or soldier's heart. Those are not terms that I'm familiar with.
Combat fatigue was the accepted term.
Okay. Very good. Let's go to Bob from Wilmington with a question. Bob, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello. I heard you mention the shipyard. That was sort of my comment. It just, what did you know? I guess they built the most amount of Liberty ships in World War II, or a high amount here. And just that relationship and the houses and Sunset Park and the effect it had on the area. I'll hang up and listen to your comment.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Thanks for that added dimension of the shipyard impact, particularly the housing that the so-called temporary housing that went up to house the workers. Many of those developments are still in use today.
Yeah, he mentioned Sunset Park.
Sunset Park was part of the community, but he's probably thinking about Maffitt Village and the Greenfield Lake areas. And also Hillcrest at Dawson and 15th, which are still in use today. They were built for black shipyard workers and non-commissioned officers.
Okay. We don't have a lot of time left, so I want to mention a couple of things. Clarification, I'd mentioned earlier, a soldier's heart. That apparently, I'm told by our producer, Claudia, is a term from the Civil War era, soldier's heart. And also, let's see if we can get to Jana from Wilmington. Jana, very quickly, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question has to do with the women Air Force service pilots who were stationed at Camp Davis during World War II.
Okay. Wilbur, any comments about that
quickly? Camp Davis was the first duty station for the WASP after they finished their training at Sweetwater, Texas, and they were flying targets, pulling targets for anti-aircraft purposes for training.
That'll have to do it for this edition of Coastline. We thank you very much for joining us today. Our guest has been Wilbur Jones, a local military historian. Wilbur, thank you so much for being here with us. And we'd like to invite you to join us next time, this time next week for Coastline with your regular host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Our producer is Isabel Shepherd. Thank you, Isabel, for great work and prep for this show. And our phone screener today was Claudia Thompson. Thank you, Claudia. Ken Campbell was our audio engineer. I'm Cleve Callison, executive producer. Thank you for listening to this broadcast of Coastline.